Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I'm Matt.
And today we are answering your listener questions.
Yes, Joel, as usual, we are going to answer five listener questions. A few of them that we are going to discuss are, should we continue to invest when we know that there might be a recession coming? Another one is, do you have to get your car repaired when it's been damaged? In this case, hail damage. And we're also going to go over the power of compounding interest plus a couple others. So I'm looking forward to tackling those on this episode, buddy.
Yeah, man. Should be good. Our listeners just keep sending in great questions. And by the way, if you want to know how to submit your question, you just go to howtomoney.com/ask. And we're trying to take as many questions as we can on the show. By the way, before we get to these questions, Matt, I wanted to mention something that a couple of people have brought up in the Facebook group since our episode about cutting the cord and the best streaming options. They've talked about buying your own modem as opposed to renting a modem from your internet provider. And that's totally brilliant.
Yeah, I like that little hack.
Yeah, because renting the modem from your internet provider can cost $5 a month or potentially even more. And I've done that before too, just to eliminate that fee. I did some research. I got a modem router combo that worked with the cable company that I got internet through. And it saved me just that recurring annoying fee every single month. And it usually pays for itself in 8 to 10 months. And so anybody who is paying that pesky fee on their bill every month, well, it's worth considering doing the research and finding something that works for you that you can own as opposed to having to rent.
Nice, man. I need to keep that in mind because currently we've got a deal going on, like one of the special promotions, and the modem isn't included. Like, it's not broken down within that. But I'm guessing when that special promotion runs out and the rates increase, that might be something that they add back.
And when that happens, that's when you start shopping, get your own, and save that money. And by the way, I know there were a lot of people commenting on how much internet costs when you don't have a package. And depending on where you live, it can be really expensive. It really depends on how competitive your market is.
Yeah.
And to be honest, most markets in this country just aren't very competitive. We have these monopoly providers who charge a lot of money. And because of that, our ability to shop and save money is incredibly hindered. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't try. And so if you do have another competitor in your area that offers internet service, it's worth checking with that provider to see what sort of deal that you can get. Be persistent. Keep asking. And make sure to ask the provider that you're currently with too. And the best way to do this, Matt, as we've mentioned before, is on Twitter. If you can find customer service reps from that company on Twitter, the social media customer service teams are typically the best and most responsive. You're most likely to actually make some headway if you reach out to their social media team there.
And Joel, let me go ahead and introduce our beer for this episode. It is called Fancy Dance, and this is by Skydance Brewing Company. This one was sent in to us by Patrick out in Oklahoma. This is going to be a New England style India Pale Ale, which is one of our favorite styles. And so I'm looking forward to this one.
Yeah, me too. And we'll give our thoughts on this beer at the end of the episode. But all right, Matt, on to the subject at hand, which is listener questions. And I say we go ahead and get to the first one.
All right, let's do it.
Hello, Joel and Matt. Thank you for an amazing podcast. This is Sharath from Glendale, California. And my question to you is, should we buy stocks or ETFs if we know there is a recession maybe around the corner? Like, it's just an assumption for now, but it seems like a correction is imminent. So should we just wait until the recession to buy the stocks or ETFs, or should we just buy now and buy later again? Thank you.
Ooh, Sharat, that's a great question. And I think it's a question that's on a lot of folks' minds.
I'm thinking about it right now.
Yes, me too. And a lot of people have been predicting a recession for a while. You said it might be imminent, but really, who knows? And I don't know. I'll tell you this. I am not smart enough to predict a recession. There's this joke that has been told for years that Wall Street analysts have predicted 9 out of the last 5 recessions. And that's because there are so many people forecasting potential downturns, many of which never occur. And you can get caught up in it pretty easily. So my initial suggestion would be to turn off the channels where you're listening to analysts telling you there's going to be a recession, because our predictive capabilities of what's going to happen in the economy and with the stock market just aren't very good. And I'll say this, I've had conversations with people for a couple of years now that were nervous to invest in stocks because they thought things had climbed too high. And so many of them just stopped their contributions because of that. But if you did that 2 years ago, you've missed out on a good bit of run-up. So predicting a recession, well, it's a difficult game and one I don't want to partake in.
So Joel, no joke. This is a conversation that we have often, I guess, when folks ask us, they're like, what do y'all think about the market? And we're like, I don't know. But I was talking to...
Keep going.
Yeah. I was talking to a fellow groomsman for, I was in my brother-in-law's wedding and we're driving down for his bachelor party and he's really big into investing and he was just saying, man, I'm telling you, there's going to be a correction. We're overdue. And this was in 2014 and there has not been the type of correction that he was calling for. And so that's just a small little case study, right? Where, you know, we expected it to have happened by now. He was slowing down his investing. And the fact is that has not happened. And again, had you stopped investing, you would have missed out on some massive gains that we've had over the past 5 years. So Sharat, you know, a good question to ask yourself right now, though, is are you getting either a current or future tax advantage by continuing to invest in the market? Also, do you need that money anytime soon? Because if you're getting a tax break and you're looking at maybe 7 or more years out, we would feel comfortable saying to continue to invest in the market despite the correction that we know is going to happen at some point. The market will correct some. But the fact is, we do not know when that is going to happen. And as long as you're invested for the long term and that you are receiving additional benefits, in particular, you're receiving those tax benefits by investing in a tax advantage account, you're still going to come out ahead over the long run to continue to invest.
Yeah, I love, Sharat, when you said maybe you should be buying now and buying later. I think this is a great strategy to employ. You can't time the market, so completely avoiding regular investing is a bad idea. But holding back some of your funds to be able to contribute more when a recession does eventually happen, well, that's not a bad idea in my opinion. But be aware that there's a danger that you actually spend that money or do something rash with it while you're waiting to invest the funds. So if that's a possibility, I would rather you put the money in now, despite the market being pretty much at all-time highs.
Yeah, and in reality, Joel, most folks are actually dollar cost averaging because they have money taken out of their paycheck automatically, or maybe they have an automatic withdrawal out of their account, maybe once every 2 weeks or maybe even once a month, but that's happening on a regular basis. And so the benefit of investing in regular increments, right, at dollar cost averaging, is that it spreads out that risk of buying at the incorrect time. And so Sharat, you might be in a unique position where you have funds, you know, like a lump sum on hand to put a lot of money into the market. And so luckily for most investors out there, by investing regularly, we're able to decrease the amount of risk that we might expose ourselves to by trying to time the market.
Yeah, there's an old saying that says timing the market is better than timing the market. And really, I think you need a repeatable strategy to avoid psyching yourself out and mistiming, making mistakes. Most people don't really have the behavioral fortitude to stick to their guns and to make decisions based on fact rather than fear. And I think for that reason, dollar cost averaging, it's the easiest to automate. And when we automate things, there's much less likelihood that we're going to actually make mistakes. And our behavior is such a part of how we invest. Human emotions essentially conspire against us to make poor decisions. And so I totally understand where your head is at, Sharat, that you assume that a recession is coming soon, like many people. And like Matt said, there is in all likelihood in the next couple of years going to be some sort of correction. We don't know how big, how long, and what it's going to look like. And I think because of that, I'd recommend to continue on a dollar cost averaging path because it's just so hard to actually create a strategy that would lead you to timing the market well, and then sticking to that strategy becomes even harder. And Matt, we covered this topic in a lot of detail back in episode number 37 called Timing the Stock Market.
I remember that one.
Yeah, and there are just so many reasons to avoid it that we can't extrapolate in the answer to this question, but hopefully we've covered some of the high points.
Yeah, what we said then is still true. So we have a couple more questions coming up right after the break, including a question from a listener in New Zealand. All right, Joel, we are back and let's go ahead and get rolling on that next question.
Hi guys, Brad from New Zealand here. I just want to start off by saying a big thank you very much for the podcast that you guys put out. My wife and I have already learned quite a lot from you guys that we implement into our daily lives, especially frugal versus cheap. Now, we are looking at starting a family and I've just listened to your podcast about how much kids really cost to raise. And according to my own research, here in New Zealand, it costs on average 14,000 New Zealand dollars to raise a child from 0 to 18. Now, that being the case, and not knowing how long it's going to take us to conceive, I've already started saving that $14,000 by splitting it into 26 payments from our fortnightly wages. So my question is, what should I be doing with this money while we are waiting for baby to join us? Obviously, there'll be costs and stuff along the way, but is it worth putting it into a term deposit for 6 months, for 9 months, for a year? Or is there a better option that you think we might be able to look into? Look forward to hearing your answers and your thoughts. Thank you very much once again for everything. Cheers.
Brad, thank you so much for your question. By the way, Matt, he's from New Zealand. New Zealand's on my bucket list. I want to get there.
I have not been there. Yeah.
I hear there are way more sheep than people there. And you know what? I'm a huge fan of Flight of the Conchords. Those guys are New Zealanders, and they are awesome.
So the only song I know by them is It's Business Time, but that's a really good one. So you might want to check that one out if you haven't, if you haven't heard it.
All right, let's get down to business then, all right? But not that kind of business. Kids, it turns out, from what Brad is saying, are really expensive across the pond too. So first off, Brad, congrats to you and your wife. And Matt and I would totally say kids are worth the money, because our family, we're about to have kid number three. And Matt, you're about to have kid number four. Kids are the best.
Yeah, Brad, congrats on the decision to start growing your family, but also congrats on doing an amazing job on budgeting, preparing in advance for your child costs already. Man, you are a planner, and you are likely also going to be able to get by with spending less just by making some frugal decisions. Man, so often some of these major expenses that show up at different stages in our life are able to be reduced just by thinking about them ahead of time and being thoughtful with the amount of money that we're setting aside.
Yeah, and I think in that episode that Brad was referencing where we talked about the cost of kids, Matt, we talked about the reality versus what the stats bear out. Well, it's a different story, and kids aren't really as expensive as these headlines make us think. So I love that Brad is setting aside the headline number. Brad, I think you're going to have money left over, which is great. And there's going to be awesome things that you can do with that excess money. And I think, too, like you mentioned in your question, you and your wife are taking some of the things that we talk about on the show and you're putting them into practice. And because of that, you're spending less, you're making frugal choices. And in all likelihood, that means you're going to do the same when it comes to the decisions that you make for your child. So you're making a conservative choice to save more than you're likely going to need. And your frugal attitude means that you're going to have money left over, which is great.
And so, Brad, the question that you're asking is what to do with that money that you're going to set aside. And you definitely don't want to think about investing that money if you are thinking more on a short-term sort of cycle, right? Investing is reserved for a minimum of maybe 5 years to even 7 years. And so if you're looking at setting aside and earmarking this money for maybe some of those immediate costs with having a baby, whether it be medical costs, different things that you want to do with baby once he or she is on the scene in those first few years, you want to keep that money liquid and easily accessible. However, if you have a longer time frame in mind, and maybe you're also considering setting some money aside for higher education, whatever it is that you want to save money for 10, maybe even 20 years down the road, certainly invest that money. You can invest that in the market just like you normally would for your retirement, but it all comes down to what you want to use that money for. Long-term money, 7+ years, feel free to invest that. But money that you want to use in the near term, around 5 years or less, you want to make sure that you keep that money liquid and easily accessible.
Yeah, and I'm not familiar with the savings plans for college in New Zealand or what the average price of a college education is in New Zealand even. So we don't have specific advice for you based on that. But if you are saving for bigger future expenses like college or your kid's potential wedding date, well, then that does make sense. But if we're talking about these expenses that you're going to incur now, and you're in a phase where you will be incurring expenses buying a stroller, a crib, there's so many things that you're adding into your house right now that you're spending money on. And we would recommend stashing that money that you're setting aside into the highest safe yield you can find. And that's in all likelihood going to be an online savings account, at least in the United States. We have so much competition right now in that sphere that the options are plentiful for finding a really good rate of return on short-term money. So for the money that you're putting in, that's going to be exiting that account again pretty quickly in order to buy all that stuff for your new kid. That's the stuff that you want to keep in just kind of a general savings account, making as big of a safe return as you can find.
And again, Brad, congrats on making the decision to grow your family. Parenthood is one awesome adventure.
No doubt. All right, Matt, let's get to the next question about repairing a car after an insurance claim.
Hey guys, this is Cassie calling from Dallas. to ask what you guys think about getting a car's hail damage repaired. So Dallas recently had some pretty bad storms and my car got hit. So do I take the insurance money and put that into savings or do something wise with it in that regards, or do I actually get the car repaired? I do plan to drive this car for another 5 to 7 years. So is it really worth cosmetically updating it? That would really be the only reason to do the repair. So what are your thoughts on that? Take the money and save it or put it back into the car? Thanks.
Hey, Cassie, thanks so much for that question. And quickly, you didn't mention how old your car is, but we love that you're planning to keep it for another 5 to 7 years. Joel and I would even challenge you to see if you can maybe even keep it for, I don't know, 7 to 10, 10 to 12. The longer you're able to keep that car running in good shape, as long as it does what you need it to do, that is something I would encourage everybody to do. Personally, man, I feel we just spend so much money on transportation and it is not necessary.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Anytime you can dial back the amount of money that you spend and just increase the time frame that you stay in the current car that you're in, you're able to grow the gap and save more and take that money and invest it, do something wise with it, save for the future. And so, yeah, challenge out there to everybody driving an old car. See if you can make it last a little bit longer than you think you can. And you'll be happy with the money you save if you're able to do that. So one of the first things that pops up with a question like this is, isn't it an insurance fraud to not get the repair done if you have a check cut your way after an accident? The answer is not necessarily. It would be insurance fraud if you made another claim for that unfixed problem sometime in the future. So let's say Cassie made a claim 2 years down the road and said, I've got hail damage again.
I've got twice as many dents on my car.
Then that would be insurance fraud, right? That'd be a big problem. If you own the car outright and your insurance company cuts you a check, you don't have any obligation necessarily to fix the car. It's really a choice that you get to make. If you have a loan on the car that you're driving or you're in a lease, you don't really get to make this decision. This is really a decision that people with paid off vehicles get to make.
And Cassie, really a lot of this is a personal decision. So much of this comes down to how you feel about driving a car with some hail damage. Personally, I don't care a ton about what my car looks like. Mostly, it's just to get me from point A to point B. And Joel, for us, we live in a big city, right? In Atlanta. Like Cassie, she lives in Dallas. You just get a lot of sort of natural wear and tear on the outside of your vehicle that is inevitable when you live in a major city. And so personally, I like to make sure my car is washed. You know, I don't like it being all grimy and gross from all the junk that falls from the tree all over it. You know what I'm talking about? It gets like the tree goop all over it.
I know that well.
That, and I like the inside of my vehicle to be cleaned. I don't like there to be dirt everywhere. But as far as like a little ding on the door here, even a scrape, the corner bumper actually got hit recently when we were in a parking lot. Like, I was totally annoyed at that in particular because nobody stuck around. But guess what I wasn't going to do? I wasn't going to file a claim, see my insurance rates hike up just to get that money. I'm just going to live with it. It's not that big of a deal for me. But again, that's me personally. Cassie, you might have a completely different definition as to what is acceptable for you to drive on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, and that brings up the point that we have to address of, we don't know how bad the damage was in Cassie's case. I'm not sure if it was a $1,500 repair or a $3,000 repair, but consider raising your deductible, Cassie and everyone out there, to avoid making smaller claims with your insurance company. If we're talking about a $1,500 or $2,000 repair, that is something you want to have the savings built up for in order to address out of pocket. Making an insurance claim is for bigger emergencies. You don't want to do it in small money circumstances. And that's because your insurance rate is going to increase likely for each of the next 3 years. And so the money you think you saved by having the insurance company pay for the repair to something like hail damage is ultimately going to be eaten away and more over the next few years as your premiums increase. So if you've got the emergency fund for it, if you've got the savings, increase your deductible on a car to as high as you can go. Typically, that's going to be about $1,000. If you've got that $250 deductible, you want to raise that sucker up as quick as possible.
And quickly, it's good to address resale. Cassie, I'm not sure if you've got that in mind. If you're thinking, well, what if I fix it? Maybe I'll get more money for it down the road. But keep in mind that we are going to encourage you to keep that car for at least 7 years, maybe even 10 to 12 years. And so a decade down the road, a vehicle that's that old that has hail damage versus a vehicle that doesn't have hail damage, there's not going to be nearly as much difference in price that you feel it would make today if you were to sell that vehicle. So really, don't worry about resale. Just keep in mind that if you do make those repairs on your vehicle, that you're doing it for you. And that's totally fine. If you've accepted the fact that this is going to be for me, I don't like having a car with hail damage, just realize that you are doing it for yourself and that it's not going to make a huge difference down the road when it comes to resale.
Yeah, Matt, that's a great point. I think really when it comes down to fixing exterior damage on a car that isn't vital to the way it works, it becomes personal. And that money that you have, you just have to ask yourself kind of an honest question. Would I rather drive around town in a car that isn't beat up looking and spend that money on the repair, or drive a beat up car and pocket the money and do something else with it that I prioritize? And for me, I don't mind driving a beat up car. I've done it for a long time. My Nissan Leaf actually looks all right now, but for a lot of years, I drove cars that looked kind of crummy, and I don't mind. I really don't care. But really, like you said, it's a personal decision. So, all right, we got a couple more questions, including one about filing quarterly taxes, and we'll get to those right after the break.
All right, Joel, we've got a couple more questions. And before we get to that one about quarterly taxes, we have one that addresses the core concept of compounding interest.
Hey, guys, this is Michelle from Memphis. My question is about the power of compounding interest, which you guys bring up on the show pretty often. I understand how it works with cash in my bank account, but I'm a little confused about how it applies to a Roth IRA or other investment portfolios. Let's suppose my portfolio grows at 8% a year. It seems to me that the compounding power would be much less than that annual growth, because most of that growth is due to gain in market value, and only a small portion, the dividends, is being reinvested. I'm pretty sure that my understanding of this is wrong, so I would love some clarification on how compounding interest works with non-liquid investments. Thanks.
Michelle, that is such a great question. And compounding interest, as we've mentioned before on the show, it is this phenomenon that can, over the decades, completely change your financial future. You don't have to be rich to invest in stocks. You become rich because you invest in the stock market over a long period of time because of quote unquote compounding interest. And so I think at this point we have to discuss what we mean when we say compounding interest, because ultimately, Matt, we're kind of actually referring to what we would call compounding returns or compounding growth, not necessarily, if we're going to get specific in terminology, compounding interest when we're talking about what happens when you invest your money in the stock market, right?
Yeah, exactly. When we use that phrase compounding interest to refer to our portfolios, oftentimes that's incorrectly used. Michelle, you're talking about the increase in market value and the dividends. As those things increase, there is compounding that is happening. And essentially, that's what we want you to focus on, the power of that compounding, not necessarily the interest, right? Because it's not like a checking account where you are receiving an actual rate of return on your money, where we could correctly refer to that as compounding interest. But the compounding aspect is what we want to focus on. And so when it comes to your portfolio, your returns are what are compounding. That market value growing, which you mentioned, is what leads to outsized gains over time.
Yeah, a key point in this is that we are assuming that the profits that you're making in the stock market are reinvested. So when your share prices appreciate or you receive dividends, when you don't take that money off the table, when you leave that invested inside of the market, you're going to experience compounding growth over a long period of time.
Exactly. Yeah, the gains on your gains.
That's right. Ultimately, in a lot of ways, I think your question, it might be a matter of semantics. You might be getting hung up on terminology, and there are going to be a lot of people that you're going to hear out there using the phrase compound interest, like Matt and I have for a long time. And in reality, what they're referring to is compounding growth over time that you're going to experience in the market as you continue to invest and you reinvest the profits and the dividends that you receive. And so try not to get hung up on that, because it is something that you're going to hear a lot. And at the same time, we'll try to be a little more clear when we're discussing this in the future. But really, more than anything, compounding rules. Albert Einstein called it the eighth wonder of the world. And I think for good reason. It is impressive to me the kind of wealth that you can build even if you'll just invest a little bit of money over a long period of time. It's a beautiful thing. And yeah, that's a huge part of the reason why we encourage people to start investing as early as possible. All right. And Matt, let's get to our final question for this episode.
Hey guys, my name is David. I am from Kansas. I had a question that's more for Matt. I am a wedding filmmaker here in Kansas. I had a question about quarterly taxes. I am looking at paying about $10,000 in taxes this year. I've been trying to pay quarterly just because as I've grown my business the past couple of years, I'm realizing how painful tax time can be. So trying to break that up a little bit. But I didn't know, now that I'm looking at paying more and more for taxes, if there's an account that money could be going into versus paying quarterly, account that could be accruing some interest. I know there might be some penalties for not paying quarterly as a self-employed individual, but I didn't know if there would be another way to have that money growing interest and paying at the end of the year versus quarterly. I know money is pretty psychological, so I've just been trying to pay quarterly and just get that money out of here versus keeping it, but I didn't know if there was a better way to go about that. Just let me know. Thanks.
Oh, sweet. Matt, a question for you. Looks like I can sit back and relax on this one.
A little small business question for me.
Yeah. That being said, you as a small business person, you feel tax time more acutely than most of us folks who work a 9-to-5 day job for an employer. Isn't that true?
Yeah, man, that is true. For the past 11 or so years, I've been paying quarterly estimates, which, like David said, is not the most fun thing to have to manually take that money, set it aside, pay it towards the government. You feel it a little more than when it just gets automatically withdrawn from your paycheck every couple of weeks.
It doesn't like warm your heart as you send that money off every quarter.
Totally sucks. But the fact is, I think there are more folks who need to be paying quarterly estimates than actually are. Technically speaking, anyone who isn't actually a full-time employee of a company but is employed is technically self-employed. So because of that, taxes are not withheld from their paycheck. You know, they might receive a check once a month or even once every 2 weeks, like a normal employee, a normal full-time employee. But in reality, taxes aren't being withheld. And also, by that definition, contract employees are self-employed as well. And you know, the same thing goes for folks who have side gigs as well, like if you drive for Lyft or Uber.
Yeah, basically, if you receive a 1099 in the mail, which happens if you've made over $600 from a particular employer or venture.
A 1099 miscellaneous.
Yeah, those are the good ones, right?
Yeah.
And if you expect to owe over $1,000 in taxes, you should start making quarterly estimated payments.
Yeah, Joel, that's right. And if you are not making those quarterly estimates, you, like you said, David, you can get hit with some penalties by the IRS. It's pretty complicated how the IRS calculates those penalties on underpayments. They use Form 2210 to calculate exactly how much you're going to get penalized. But the fact is, you're talking about owing $10,000. And if you were to take that money over the course of a year and invest that in a high interest savings account, for instance, CIT, I checked today, and they're paying 2.3%. You're only talking about $230 that you'd be able to make on your money. And that's before having the IRS flag you, and you know, because you're not in compliance. So personally speaking, in the past 11 years, I have always paid my quarterlies, even though I like to optimize every single dollar, right? Like I hate the fact that I have money that might be sitting somewhere that's not earning me money. But that being said, I found it's easier just to go ahead and pay those quarterlies. Like you said, it's really psychological. It gets it out of your bank account. And plus, it's just easier to stomach paying those quarterlies than paying that massive lump sum come tax time.
Yeah, I think, Matt, paying those estimated quarterlies, well, it's easier to not spend the money if you pay your taxes on time, right? If it's sitting in your bank account, there's a little bit more of a temptation. But also, it's just not worth the risk. You mentioned that you could make an extra $230 a year by putting that money into a high interest savings account. Well, that's really not all that much when you calculate the risk involved of getting audited or having just the IRS poke their nose in your affairs based on the fact that you weren't complying. This is something where you want to play by the rules because the downsides are far worse than the upsides of not doing so.
Yeah, that's right. And David, I'm sure you've found that it's pretty easy to pay those quarterlies as well. For those who haven't done that yet, you can go to EFTPS. I actually don't even know what that stands for anymore. I knew maybe 10 years ago when I first set that account up, but we will link to that in our show notes. But you can go to EFTPS, which is the website set up by the Treasury to pay your personal or business quarterly estimates. Or you can go to DirectPay, which is set up by the IRS, which has to be a newer site because I know that DirectPay wasn't around when we were first setting up our business and when we first got set up with EFTPS.
When you were first starting up, you had to deliver them by Stagecoach, right?
Yeah, that's how I got suckered into Wells Fargo because the whole Stagecoach thing. But the one thing to note with DirectPay is that you can only make quarterly estimates for your personal income only there, whereas with EFTPS, personal and business right there. A couple dates to go ahead maybe and put on your calendar for Q3. You want to make sure you have those quarterlies paid by September 16th of this year. And Q4, you need to make sure you have those paid by January 15th of next year. And I say put it on your calendar because literally just put that on your calendar. You can have it on there as a reminder, set a little alert. That way you don't miss that payment.
Yeah, Matt, I don't know where I would be if it weren't for calendar reminders. They saved my butt so much.
And then David, a last little tip is there's a way around having to file more paperwork and pay those estimates. If you're single, but you also happen to have a W-2 job, you can ask your employer to increase your withholdings on your regular paycheck. That way, in essence, you're paying quarterlies on your filmmaking business through your full-time job because all of your personal income essentially gets lumped together. Or if you happen to be married and you're filing jointly with your spouse, if your spouse has a W-2 or a full-time job, then they can modify their W-4. They can just check in with HR and have them make those adjustments. In either case, you're going to see that W-2 paycheck decrease slightly, but that's sort of one workaround to make sure that you are satisfying the IRS as far as the amounts of money being withheld and sent to them essentially as quarterly estimates, but you're just able to avoid that additional hassle and those calendar reminders if that's just not your thing.
All right, man, I'm going to make a petition right now that more of the questions be directed at you. It just makes it a little easier on my end.
Well, Joel, you say that, but you know, as the podcast continues to grow, like we're treating it more like a business. So these are things that we're going to address, you and me together, not just my side gig, but these will become questions regarding our side gig.
That's true. All right, let's get back to the beer that we had on the show today, Matt. Listener Patrick sent in a beer called Fancy Dance by Skydance Brewing Company out of Oklahoma. So well, yeah, what was your take on this New England style IPA?
So Joel, after our beer hiatus, I'm just glad that we're back to drinking beer. And not only that, but a style that we really like. This is a New England style IPA. This one is triple dry hops. So in my mind, it has more of those hoppy, herbally notes, which I have found myself coming to enjoy more and more as I get to explore this delicious style. What about you, man?
Yeah, I feel like anytime an IPA is dry hopped, it lends to the aromatics. So you kind of get more of a sensory feel for the beer as opposed to just experiencing it through the taste buds on your tongue. This IPA in particular was a little more sweeter and a little fruitier than most IPAs of this style, but I appreciated where they were going. And you know what? I really like the name, Fancy Dance. It makes me want to create a dance of my own that's super fancy.
When your trademark Joel dances, if anyone's ever seen you at a wedding, they know what I'm talking about and everybody else wishes they knew what I was talking about.
It's one of a kind. Let's just leave it at that. Basically, it's like river dance mixed with a rabid animal running through the woods.
Now, if only we had not just a picture and not just video, but I want to see a boomerang of that. So,
you know what? We might be able to scrounge something up.
Yeah, I was going to say, we could probably dig around on the phones and find that.
But if we do, we'll post it on Instagram.
Yeah, on that note, if you are not following us on Instagram, you can find us at How to Money Pod. Check us out. We like to post fun stuff that has to do with the show that week. That's always a fun place to interact. And Joel, we'll have our show notes up on our website at howtomoney.com. And Joel, let's not forget about our book giveaway from last Monday. This was Ramit's book, I Will Teach You to Be Rich. A big thanks to everyone who entered that giveaway by leaving us a review. And we entered all those names into the randomizer and we have our winners. They are Andy BBB, Kpluck17, and Fiffy Tiffy. So thanks again to everyone. And we will be reaching out to you three here shortly.
And if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, I just want to say thank you. Matt and I are thankful that it's meant something to you. And we appreciate you being a part of the How to Money community.
Yeah, Joel, especially if they're listening to the very end, where at the end of the show, every single week, we sign off. We say, until next time, best friends out.
Oh, I forgot what we said. What do I say?
I thought you were going to say, do me a solid.
that soon. All right, best friends out.
Best friends out.